This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I was in Northern California this week and experienced my first West Coast earthquake. It was a magnitude 4. But how strong is a 4? What does that mean, anyhow? As an earthquake newbie, I wasn't quite sure. But it appears I am not alone. Sarah Zhang, a science writer for Wired, calls the Bay Area her home, so she's no stranger to earthquakes. But after her apartment got rattled by that one on Monday, even she began wondering just how useful the numbers are.
So I've caught myself thinking, you know, how much worse can a 6 be than a 4? And when I look at the numbers, like 4 and 6, it seems like, can't be that bad, right?
And that earthquake happened just a day after Zhang wrote the article, "The way we measure earthquakes is stupid." She spoke with Lucy Jones, a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. She's also concerned that the public doesn't get earthquake magnitude. And now Dr. Jones joins us from KPCC in Pasadena to continue our discussion. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
In 2000, you wrote, "I hate the Richter scale."
Right. And I had to say, this is a hard thing for a seismologist to say, but I'm often in the position of trying to explain it to people, and it's not easy to explain. It's not a very intuitive process. It's also arbitrary and empirical, which bothers me as a scientist.
Wasn't it given up in the 70s, the Richter scale?
No. All right. So the Richter scale, as the definition exactly like Richter defined it, we gave up in the 90s, as really because of computerization. What Richter did, you know, was how do you try and measure the total size of an earthquake off of a piece of paper? And there's a really limit to the dynamic range on a piece of paper, and you've got to only look at certain frequencies, et cetera. With now digital seismographs, we have so many more options open to us, we have much more accurate ways of trying to estimate the size. So we gave up his technique, but we have kept the concept, magnitude as an arbitrary empirical definition of the total size of an earthquake. It's not a definition of what you feel. He developed it back in the 20s to try and get people off of the idea that what they felt would tell them how big the earthquake was. And he's saying, really, there's a size to the earthquake that's not what you feel. It's how much energy is released in the earth. And what you feel is a combination of that with how far away you are and what soils you were in. Lots of other factors play into what you feel.
Sort of sounds like your hearing. Your hearing doesn't exactly measure how loud a sound is. It's just how you perceive the sound.
Right. There's an intensity of the sound in your ear, the decibels that you receive. That's not how much energy was released by, you know, the airplane. If you were right next to the airplane, it's much louder than if you're farther away. And seismic waves are just waves. They're exactly like sound waves. And, you know, but with an airplane, you might want to know how big the engine is. With an earthquake, we want to know how much, you know, what happened in the earth. So as seismologists, you know, we need that concept of how big is the event. Mm-hmm. But then when we use it to describe it to people, we're getting a lot of confusion. In Japan, where, of course, they have quite a few more earthquakes than we do here in California, they determine magnitude, but that's not what they release to the public. They release the intensity. What did it feel like to you? How strong was the shaking? And there's the maximum intensity, the worst that anybody got, and then the intensity at your site. And many people think that's what magnitude is. I'll often get the question, well, if it's a magnitude 8 on the San Andreas, what will it be in LA? Well, it's still a magnitude 8. That's the size of the earthquake. But the shaking is intensity 10 in the desert and intensity 8 in the city or something like that. So I like the thing of the idea of using intensity as a way to communicate with people.
Yeah, because people also confuse a magnitude 5 with a 6, and they think, 6 is just one more than a 5, when it's actually the shaking's a lot stronger.
Well,
then
right.
It's not linear.
And it's not even logarithmic, right? Richter originally defined it as the logarithm of the ground velocity. So sort of the single biggest swing on a seismograph. But a bigger earthquake releases energy over a longer time and over a bigger area. So the energy released actually goes up faster than just the logarithm. And each unit of magnitude actually represents a factor of 32 in the total energy released. And sort of the other big thing that's changed in, you know, 90 years of recording earthquakes, now that we do them on seismograms, and we've done a lot of research, a guy named Professor Keiichi Aki determined something called, or created a quantity called the seismic moment, which is also representing the total size in the earthquake, but is now a physical quantity with units that you can measure, and you can compare it to what happens in the geology with what happens on the seismograph. And it's a much more accurate way of representing that total size. And since we can now do it easily because of computers, you know, back when Aki first did this, it took months to get your moment calculated. Now we can do it in minutes. We actually use that as our primary measure of the earthquake, and then we create an equivalent magnitude, believing that the public still understands magnitude and still wants to get that information. And I think we're misinterpreting how much people understand, and we'd be much better off talking about actual seismic moment and helping people understand that big scaling effect.
Mm. When you say the seismic moment, okay, tell us what we should listen for and how we might better understand it.
Okay. The problem is if the units are complicated. And, you know, so the Northridge earthquake was 1.2 times 10 to the 19th Newton meters. I actually tried to describe that in a sound bite, and it doesn't work, right? So what we proposed back in 2000 was, let's create a unit. And Professor Aki did this great work. Let's name it after him and have it be an Aki. So if we define it as 10 to the 15th Newton meters, we can say, you know, that magnitude 5 is about one Aki. That 4 that you just felt would be about 30 milliAkis. The biggest earthquake that ever is recorded is in the teraAkis. And the smallest one we look at are microAkis, or even smaller than that. And then you start, you know, now people know those terms because of computers, right? Yeah. We have kilobyte and megabyte and gigabyte. People know what that means now. And it will help people see that, in fact, a magnitude 4 and a magnitude 6, you're talking about 30 milliAkis versus 30 Akis. It's 1,000 times bigger.
Huh. So is that what those magnitudes are? They're measured in Akis?
Well, the we haven't yet gotten it officially accepted as a formal. We still say Newton meters, and that's complicated for people.
I think so.
So, yeah, I'm hoping that we can get this through. We're actually putting a proposal together of how to. There's an official process by which you define units. There's a commission that maintains the metric system, and we're proposing the Aki as a unit. And then we could use it and start saying these, more intuitive ways of understanding the energy in an earthquake.
And what does an earthquake mean to a scientist? You're trying to get this so that the public understands it, but what use is it to scientists, earthquakes? Different than what the public generally thinks.
Well, right. I mean, there's a couple of things to... We see earthquakes often as tools for understanding the Earth. So when an earthquake happens, it releases waves and they travel through the Earth. And just like we can use a CAT scan, we're basically doing a CAT scan of the Earth using the earthquake waves. They also tell us how the mountains are being made. When I see an earthquake, the 4 on the Hayward Fault last week in San Francisco, that's actually showing us how San Francisco Bay is being created and opened up as different pieces of the crust move around. And then there's also sort of that fundamental physics question, why do we have an earthquake? Why do we have an earthquake today and not tomorrow? What's the strength of the rock? What makes it break? All of those are pretty interesting scientific questions, which is what the scientists are really focused on. So we use moment. We often use magnitude as an easier to say. Magnitude 3 is easier than rattling off the moment.
So what are the main factors that you take into account when you determine its power and its impact? Is it what the Earth is made out of, where it is, or what are the factors going on the ground that say, oh, this is a big one, this is a smaller one?
Actually, all of those things, but the most important thing is the area of the fault that moves in an earthquake. An earthquake actually is a lot like snapping your fingers. When you snap your fingers, you have two surfaces in frictional contact. Because you're pushing them together, there's friction that keeps them moving sideways. You push hard enough to overcome that friction, and it moves suddenly, releasing energy in the form of a sound wave. If you didn't push your fingers together, they would slide past each other without making a noise, which shows you that if the fault could open up, you wouldn't have an earthquake. You can't have an earthquake if the fault opens up because there's no friction. Right? So, but you also can't snap your fingers at a point. You need a surface. And the same thing with an earthquake. They do not happen at epicenters. They happen over a surface, one side moving past the other. And the area of that surface times the amount that one side slips past the other, and then, in fact, times the rigidity of the rock, how much the rock mm-hmm. is resisting being moved. That's what we define as the seismic moment. And the cool part about that is you can do that with geology. You can go out and measure the length of the fault and estimate the width and get how much one side slipped and compare that to what we do with the seismographs, and we're getting the same answer. So it means that we can correlate what happens on a modern seismograph with what happened historically. That's how we can tell you that the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco was a magnitude 7.8.
Well, I love that finger analogy because it works when you look at it and think about how you press harder and it makes a bigger snap.
Right. Well, and the other part about it is, think about it. When a seismologist talks about an earthquake, we talk about the movement of a fault. We're talking about one finger moving past the other. But when just about anybody else talks about an earthquake, they're talking about what they felt. So they're talking about the sound that was created. And right there, there's a fundamental disconnect that I've seen many times lead to confusion, because the seismologists tend to be talking about a different thing than most people are.
Well, Lucy, I want to thank you for talking about it, because I think you cleared up a lot of what we don't understand.
Well, great. That's wonderful.
Lucy Jones is a seismologist with the U.S. Geological Survey based in Los Angeles, California. We're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk about how a technologist and an artist team up to make artwork as big as Los Angeles. Big. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, the story of an art museum that's taken on the role of matchmaker. The Los Angeles County Museum of Art has been pairing up artists and technologists to see what new art the two groups can make together. Science Friday's SciArts producer Annie Minhoff headed to L.A. to check out one of these new art projects, and she joins me now to talk about it. Welcome.
Thank you, Ira.
So, Annie, why would an art museum get into the matchmaking business? Why pair up an artist and technologist?
Well, Amy Heibel runs this program, Art and Technology, out of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And she says, really, the museum just sees this as one more way that they can be of service to artists. So you have a lot of artists who have very big ideas about how they want to use tech in their work, but maybe they don't have the tech know-how, or maybe they don't have the access to tools that you have at, say, you know, a Google or a SpaceX. And so what the museum can do is really bring together these two players and kind of create a sandbox where artists and technologists can play around and experiment.
And so how do you decide which artist to pair up with what tech company?
Yeah, it's kind of voodoo, right? Because yeah. They really have to get along. So the museum has actually taken a cue from the dating world. And what they do is they invite the artists and the technologists down to the museum, and everyone talks with everyone else for about 15 minutes, and it kind of looks like a speed dating session. So here's LACMA's Amy Heibel.
We're not making an arranged marriage. We're creating an environment where they can meet each other, and we're letting natural connections emerge, and then we're encouraging those.
So one of the pairings that emerged from one of these speed dating sessions was between the artist John Craig Freeman and a tech CEO named Brian Mullins. And so a few months ago, I flew out to LA to kind of see the artwork that these two had created. And it took me to a really interesting corner of downtown LA called Pershing Square. Downtown LA's Pershing Square doesn't look like much. It's a park built on top of an underground parking garage. There's grass, a few trees and planters, and a lot of high concrete barriers. Artist John Craig Freeman knows the park doesn't get a lot of love from Angelenos.
The residents have told me that they're ambivalent about it. Sometimes it can be an intimidating space and be a little scary even.
But today, he's out to show me and a handful of art fans another side of the square. He's created an artwork here, but to see it, we need to download a smartphone app called Layer.
And we see it right there, Layer.
As it boots up, Layer turns on my iPhone's camera.
And so if you hold your phone up now, it might take a while to start downloading assets.
But what is that?
I'm looking at my cell phone screen, and suddenly, there on the grass, is this guy. He's got a kind of pixely look about him. And behind him is a very large, very dead bird.
Oh, there he is. You see that?
Yeah.
Doesn't it look like a dead chicken?
Tourist John Watovich has his phone out, too. He says the dead bird isn't the first weird thing he's seen floating around Pershing Square.
The backpack was cool. It really was. It was huge, and it came at me.
Yes, there is a giant floating backpack. There's also a little red wagon and a beat-up fire call box. Walking through Pershing Square, I feel like I've wandered into a surrealist painting. But Craig says there's meaning behind all this madness.
So for the past couple of months, we've been going out in the city of Los Angeles and encountering people more or less at random. And we asked them what they've lost and videotaped their response.
Okay, so Matt, I'm going to just ask you a single question. Just take as much time as you need. What have you lost?
That pixely guy on the grass is Matt. Craig met him passing through Pershing Square last March. And Matt answered Craig's what have you lost question like this.
I've lost my faith in humanity.
In Craig's hands.
That's represented by a dead bird at his feet. Another person told us that they've lost their childhood, and that's represented by a red wagon just over there.
The bird, the wagon, the backpack, they all represent things people told Craig that they'd lost. Craig recreated them digitally and placed them back here in the park for us to find. There's a name for this magic trick. Augmented reality.
Augmented reality has been around for a while, but it was just about 2010 that it became easily accessible for individuals just using common cell phones.
You've probably heard of virtual reality. You put on a headset and suddenly the outside world is gone and instead there's this completely digital environment. Well, augmented reality is a little bit different. It doesn't block out capital R reality. Looking through my phone, I can still see grass, trees, the ugly concrete barriers of Pershing Square. But I'm also seeing this extra stuff that Craig's put here. Augmented reality is a digital bird lying in analog grass. Craig's been using it for art, but technology companies are pretty excited about it too, for different reasons.
Let's say someone is a field force engineer fixing a gas turbine on a jet airplane. When they look at that engine, they can actually see, as if it were special effects from a movie, but laid out in the real world, how to fix that.
That's Brian Mullins. Brian's the CEO of an augmented reality company called Daqri. And he's betting that augmented reality is going to transform how industrial workers do their jobs. In Daqri's vision of the future, engineers look at machine specs that appear right on top of the machines they're trying to fix. Brian met Craig at a meet and greet hosted by LACMA's Art and Technology program. And according to Brian, it was a meeting of the geek minds.
In just a few minutes of talking, we realized we shared so many passions.
Passion for augmented reality, for reading brainwaves.
We were kind of kindred spirits in a way.
And then Craig the artist asked Brian the technologist a pretty out there question. Could you be thinking about something you'd lost, like your keys, and then have those keys appear in front of you in augmented reality? Could you think a lost object back into being? The short answer, according to Brian, was no. But together, they started tinkering with a workaround, a way to conjure up lost objects with just your thoughts. After our digital scavenger hunt, I meet Craig, the artist at LACMA. Just like at the park, he has his iPad in front of him, though he has a different name for it.
I'm standing in front of the augmented reality viewing device.
What's different this time is this thick black rubber band that Craig has circling his head. This is an electroencephalogram headset, courtesy of Brian. And on the inside band are these tiny sensors measuring Craig's brain waves.
And now I'm going to think deeply about what it is I've lost.
It takes a second, but then with that buzz, a lost object suddenly appears on Craig's iPad.
So this is the lost print media. It's an old newspaper stand.
The newsstand looks like it's planted in the middle of the museum floor. Now, were you thinking of what you'd lost when you recalled that?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about the newsstand particularly. When that question's asked back to me, it's my response is lost home.
Craig was thinking about lost home. What he got was a newsstand. That's because that EEG headset he's wearing, it can't read thoughts. What it can do is look for patterns in Craig's brainwaves that suggest that Craig is really thinking hard about something, that he's really focusing. And when it picks up on that signal, a random lost object appears. this time?
Now we're looking at an old telephone booth for lost payphones.
It is possible to think a digital object into being. You just can't be too picky about which one. And that doesn't bother Craig. He says, we're just beginning to learn what augmented reality can do.
It's a pretty powerful experience, being able to use brainwave sensing as an interface for generating a virtual reality. I think that that's a question to start with, not one to end with.
This summer, LACMA will bring two new groups of artists and technologists together. It'll be the beginning of a whole new experiment. And who can say ahead of time what new kinds of art might materialize? For Science Friday, I'm Annie Minoff.
Great tour, Annie. Thank you for taking us on that. Can you still see those lost objects out in Pershing Square?
Absolutely. The great thing about creating your artwork in augmented reality is no one ever tells you to take your installation down. So absolutely, they're still there. If you live in the Los Angeles area, we have instructions that'll help you find those lost things at sciencefriday.com/artandtech.
Can you get the app? Can we get the app and look at this?
Yeah, it's yourself? Called Layer. Yeah. Download it.
Download it and go looking.
Go looking. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting part about this story, an interesting aspect, is that this is not actually the first time that the Los Angeles County Museum of Art has paired artists and technologists. In fact, the first time they did this was all the way back in 1967. And that program only lasted for about 4 years. But in that time, it actually included the big names in 20th century art. So Andy Warhol, Klaus Oldenburg, John Chamberlain, if you've ever gone to an art museum and
seen
the crushed up
the
car
A-list.
Sculptures, the A-list. And so all of them were alums of this first, 1967 art and technology program. And so to talk more about that, I want to bring on Patrick McCray. He's a professor of history at UC Santa Barbara, and he's actually writing a book about art and technology collaborations. Welcome, Patrick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So how did this original art and technology program get started all the way back in 1967?
The idea for the original program was the brainchild of a curator at LACMA named Maurice Tuckman. He had recently arrived at the museum, and he was eager to put Los Angeles on the cultural map. And he was from New York City, but he was interested in this idea of California as a place of the future. And he was very eager to partner artists with local California industries in the hopes that they would interact with engineers and scientists where they could get access to cutting-edge technology of the time, like lasers and video cameras and that sort of thing.
You know, back in the 60s, today you don't think that L.A. is the center of high technology companies, but there were a few around then.
It's really interesting because today we think of L.A. as a city that's primarily oriented around the entertainment industry, but it's important to remember that in the 1960s, Los Angeles was a city that was really based around aerospace and other high-tech, oftentimes defense-related industries that were very much the mainstay of the local economy.
So sort of like IBM, so things, people like that.
Companies like Lockheed and IBM and Hewlett-Packard, and then a whole array of companies that either don't exist today or have been merged or bought out by other larger entities.
Mm-hmm. And what about the artists? I know I mentioned a few of the big names, but who else was involved in this?
Yeah, you mentioned some of the big names that were involved, and the program really attracted stars from the New York City avant-garde art scene, people like Andy Warhol that you mentioned and Robert Rauschenberg. But it also brought in some younger up-and-coming artists, some of them from the East Coast, but also some from Los Angeles who were experimenting with new technologies. So one of the artists that I find really interesting is a man by the name of Rockne Krebs, who was from Washington, D.C., actually, who did a lot of work at the time with lasers to create sort of sculptures in space using laser light, which at the time was a very cutting-edge sort of thing to do.
Yeah, we don't usually think about lasers today being kind of the cutting edge, but back then...
They were invented in the early 60s, so people were very interested in them, and all they could do in those days is cut things.
Exactly. I mean, today we think of something like the laser pointer, which you can go on Amazon and buy for a few dollars and use it to amuse your cat. But in the 1960s, this was the sort of the realm of high tech, and lasers and other things like this were very big and very expensive, and they required teams of engineers and scientists to make them work, which is one of the reasons why partnering artists with technologists was a central part of the LACMA program.
And I mean, how close were these worlds of art and tech back in 1967? I mean, were collaborations like this a common thing?
They weren't that common, but although in the 1960s, there was this real boom in trying to foster art and science and art and technology collaborations. But the worlds of art and engineering were much more separate than they are today. Oftentimes, companies didn't know what to do with the artists, and there was oftentimes this sense that the artist was, you know, a crazy person with weird hair who dressed funny, and the idea of pairing them with straight-laced middle management types or engineering types oftentimes created some tensions and ruffled some feathers as there were these attempts to bring these two different cultures together.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato here with Annie Minoff. We're talking with Patrick McRae.
So Patrick, tell us about a collaboration that really worked.
One of my favorite collaborations involved an American artist by the name of Robert Whitman, who was known in the 1960s for his installations that combined visual images and sound, sort of today what we would think of as multimedia environments. And he was partnered through the LACMA program with a physicist by the name of John Forkner. Forkner had grown up in the Philadelphia area and had been trained at Drexel University, but he migrated out to California and began to work with a defense contracting firm in the Newport Beach area. And through the LACMA project, they created this installation piece, which essentially filled an entire room. They created specially designed mirrors to generate a series of optical effects. One of the most striking was to take common objects like a clock or a goldfish in a goldfish bowl and to use optics to create a sense that these objects were floating in space in a sort of this ghost-like ethereal way in a darkened room. And this collaboration had a really big impact on both of their careers. This partnership continued until John Forkner passed away in 2004, and Whitman really came to think of this engineer as an equal partner in creating art. And for the engineer Forkner, this was a very transformational moment in his life. As he told one art critic, it really expanded his aesthetic horizons as an engineer. And I think it also offered a way for this engineer who worked at a company that basically made weapon systems to humanize technology, maybe offering him an escape mechanism of sorts from his 9-to-5 job.
Speaking of art critics, how well was this stuff received by them?
That's a great question. The critics' views, frankly, were largely negative. The industries that were involved with the LACMA program tended to be large corporate entities, and they are oftentimes connected with the war in Vietnam. And art critics oftentimes went after these art and engineering collaborations as a way to criticize industry and American society in general. And another aspect of it that became very controversial, less so when the program started in 1966, but by the time all these works were exhibited at LACMA in 1971, all the artists involved were white men. There were no women, there were no people of color involved, and this became a very controversial issue that the LACMA folks had to deal with as they were getting this exhibit underway.
And we should mention, too, that some of these collaborations just straight up failed, right?
Many of them straight up failed. One of the most interesting failures, if you will, involved an American sculptor by the name of John Chamberlain. And in the 1960s, he decided to experiment with some conceptual art practices instead of his usual sculpture work. And LACMA, after considerable effort, partnered him with an entity called RAND. RAND, short for Research and Development, was the preeminent think tank of the Cold War. It was started in 1946, and it was famous for developing scenarios for fighting thermonuclear war. It's lampooned in Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove, for example. So Chamberlain shows up at RAND, which is located in Santa Monica. It was a very straight-laced sort of place. And Chamberlain starts by showing one of his experimental films in the RAND cafeteria at lunchtime. And many of the employees found it disturbing, if not outright pornographic. So Chamberlain switches gears, and he decided that he wanted to interact with the RAND scientist and see what they were thinking about. So he circulates a memo to all of the employees there that said, basically, "I'm searching for answers, not questions." And he waited to see what responses they sent back. And the responses were very negative. Most of them were variations on calling him a pervert or questioning the value of having an artist in residence. But to them, an artist was simply someone who made things or painted.
Right.
And it was sort of a sign of this sort of mutual hostility between the art and the science world at that time.
Fascinating history. Patrick McRae is professor of history at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Annie Minoff, our Sci-Fi Arts, Sci-Arts producer. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break and talk about a new play by playwright Deborah Zarloffer. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. As genetic testing becomes more widespread, we have to answer new questions like, how much do we really want to know about our family history or our predisposition to disease? Back in the early 90s, members of the Arizona Havasupai tribe didn't get the chance to answer those questions for themselves. Instead, they were answered for them by researchers at Arizona State University. ASU geneticists collected blood from the Havasupai, hoping to unlock the secret of the tribe's high rate of diabetes. What the tribe members didn't know is that those researchers were also looking for other kinds of information having to do with mental health and their tribe's origins. The court battle that followed transformed medical ethics. It also inspired a new play by one of my favorite playwrights, Deborah Zarloffer. It's called Informed Consent, and it's just opened off Broadway to rave reviews. Deborah joins me here in our New York studios. Welcome back.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I love the play.
Oh, thanks, Ira.
You know, when you were back, here in our studios in 2009, and I asked, what are you going to be doing next? And you say, I think I'm going to write a play about the genome.
Right.
And you did.
I'm a little slow, but I made it back.
What is it about the genome that captured you?
I guess I'm just interested in whatever the latest breakthroughs are, and genomic research is just moving forward exponentially. And so it raises new questions that we've never had to answer before. Our parents never had to decide what they wanted to know about their body structure, about their future, about their mm-hmm. past, and also what they want to know about their children and how much they want to know before they have children.
Right. You know, it's interesting because we talk about this new issue, that you knock around and deal with very interestingly in the play is how much do you have a right not to know?
Right.
You know, yeah. And that's exactly what the theme of the play is.
It is. And I didn't realize when I read this article and decided to write a play about it what a landmark case it wound up being. Because before that, informed consent had a lot more to do with physical harm, you know, like mm-hmm. Like Tuskegee or other studies where actual physical harm was done. But this is really psychological and emotional harm that was done with this study.
Can you give us a thumbnail of what the play's about?
Yeah. Well, the tribe's creation story is that they spring forth from the Grand Canyon, and they believe their blood is sacred. They've never given it for any other kind of research, but their rate of diabetes is so dire. It's 50% of the tribe, and there's less than 700 of them left. So they were in such a terrible situation that they were forced to turn for medical help. And what the researcher found was that the tribe originated in Eastern Asia, and so that contradicted their creation story. And that's what fascinates me, where science and religion sort of rub up against each other uncomfortably.
Mm. How did you find it? I mean, you said you were going to go write a play about genome. How did you stumble or look for this one?
Well, it's another Alfred P. Sloan Foundation play, and I had 4 days to get in a proposal. So
a whole 4 days?
Yeah, so naturally I went on Facebook, and I said, friends, send me articles. And I have a really good friend, Ben Stanger, who's at UPenn. He's a scientist and has his own lab there. And he sent me this article, and I knew immediately that was what I'd want to write about. I wrote the proposal the next day and then had to write the play.
Well, your plays now seem to be focusing on the tension between science and faith. I mean, your last play was also about science and faith, right?
Well, the last play that brought me here. I've written probably four plays since then. Yeah. But
that play was End Days.
Right.
Yeah. I thought that was a terrific play.
Thank you, Ira.
I love that one also. But that was also a question of faith. Where does faith and science intersect, and where does one begin, one end? Are they both legitimate in your own mind? That sort of thing.
Right. Well, we're all just trying to figure out how to make it through the day, how to deal with our own mortality and why we're here. And so I'm just fascinated by what people choose to believe in order to answer the big questions for themselves. And science, for me, answers those questions or asks more questions. It's where I go to sort of find wonder and awe. And but I would never want anyone who has a belief in the afterlife or any sort of higher power to have that taken away, because you know, mm-hmm. that's a source of great comfort too. So I'd love to write about a place where both points of view can be respected. But there's always tremendous tension and push and pull there. Mm-hmm.
You created, tell us about Jillian, the genetic anthropologist, and Arella, the leader of the Havasupai tribe.
Yeah. Well, Jillian is, I saw a number of TED Talks where there were scientists who might be considered a little bit fringe or maybe even crackpot, who think that we're very close to finding a way to be immortal, and that if we all just give our genomic material, that research will speed along so quickly that we'll find a way to become immortal. Our children's children will become immortal. And I thought, what if I have a character like that, and who's also in a race against time, because she knows her own genetic history and her genetic future is that she has early onset Alzheimer's. And so I wanted a character who was so driven that she would really go to any lengths, and it's to save her daughter. And then the spokesperson I have from the tribe, Arella, you know, her mother died of diabetes, and she's also worried about her daughter. So it's very much about mothers and daughters and what we pass on to the next generation.
Yeah, because there's the same conflict in her mind about her daughter as
right.
the tribe about learning what they would learn.
Exactly. And one of the things I learned, and I went down and spent a night with the tribe. The Sloan Foundation sent me down there. And one of the things I discovered is what was most devastating to them is having their story taken away from them, their creation story and their identity and who they are. And that really cracked open something for me in the play, because Alzheimer's, my main character, Jillian, is losing her story and her identity. So I thought the parallel there would really create another level to the play.
So where does the fiction come in? How does your story depart from the real court case?
Both characters I have fictionalized. My grandmother died of Alzheimer's. It's something my teacher, Marcia Norman, had said, you know, when you're at a loss, write about the thing that terrifies you most. And
take a role model, Marcia Norman.
Oh, she's amazing. Yeah. But anyway, so in my family, that's Alzheimer's, since my grandmother died of it. So I knew genetically that would be something that really was frightening for me to explore and also exciting to delve deeper into for a character. So that was not the case with the actual scientist. She wasn't mm-hmm. studying Alzheimer's. She was studying schizophrenia. So I departed in that way.
It's a little, you're allowed to.
Thank you.
You're not doing a documentary.
Thank
That's
you.
What the theater is all about, right? Well, you know, we learn new things about the genome every day. What looks like junk DNA today could tell us a lot 5 years from now.
Right.
Is there really such thing as truly informed consent when it comes to DNA?
That's a great question. And it's one of the questions I pose in the play. And I think what the takeaway is that you can't fully represent what could be looked for in a DNA sample. But if you want to keep looking further, what you need to do is come back and get permission. You have to ask for informed consent. So it's not just a piece of paper. It's a living document and a living contract between people.
Mm-hmm. But what the play has done, it has given a vehicle for med students to discuss this, because this is something they have to confront. Are they using this play?
It's been such a thrill for me, because med schools all around the country are asking to teach the play. And it was done in Cleveland at the Cleveland Playhouse and also at Jiva Theater in Rochester. And when it was done in Cleveland, Case Western was teaching it in their medical ethics classes. And so this was the case that they were studying, which was just by luck. I didn't know that when I went there. Hmm. And so they were studying six different documents over the course of the semester, and the sixth was mine. The others were all medical and legal documents. And so I got to go in and be part of the class and listen to discussions, you know, in their response mm-hmm. to the play. And I think they discovered the same thing I sort of discovered when I went down and met the tribe is that it's all very well and good to understand what informed consent is in an intellectual way, but when you put a face on it and understand the actual personal implications, it really changes the way you think about it.
Yeah. In case you just joined us, I'm talking with Deborah Zoloffer, author, playwright of Informed Consent, that's just opened off Broadway. How long a run do you have?
Just till September 13th.
Oh.
Yeah.
Any chance of getting extended?
Well, there's another play by Topher Payne coming in soon after, so I don't think we could extend very long, but maybe a little.
When you started thinking about the character here, did you have a piece of yourself in that? You talked about, was it your grandmother with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, there's a lot of me in the play. People who know me well come and say, wow, there's a lot of you in the play. And the main character is not a lovable character necessarily. She's pretty prickly. Which
she's obnoxious, all of them.
She's kind of obnoxious, yeah. And I love that about her. There aren't that many female characters in dramatic literature who are allowed to be obnoxious and pushy and desperate and angry and think they're the smartest person in the room, which is what she is. That's what she thinks. And so that was one of the things I really wanted to create, is a female protagonist who's that strong.
Well, part of that is whether she wants to be tested or not, mm-hmm. about having the disease. Did that change your mind about yourself?
Well, it's something my mother and I have talked about after my grandmother had Alzheimer's. And it was amazing to me because I think we had both sort of thought, well, someday. But after seeing the play, my mom is getting tested. She's actually done tests and hasn't gotten results back yet. But I was surprised. And people who've come to see the play, we've had couples come see it who thought they knew where they stood on getting their children tested or getting tested mm-hmm. themselves. And then they have arguments after the play. And so if I can make people argue with each other, I feel like I've done a good thing.
That's what it's all about. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with a playwright, Deborah Zoloffer, about Informed Consent, a terrific play. It does make you walk away discussing it, even with strangers. Everybody's talking about it. And there's a scene in the play where Jillian, the scientist, seems to be giving a TED talk. Mm-hmm. She's making some fantastical claims. Was that a little bit of a dig at TED Talks?
It's not. I love TED Talks. I could listen to them all day, really, online. So it's not. I'm fascinated by them. And so people have asked me that. I guess I can never get tired of them.
Yeah.
So putting them on stage was fun for me.
Mm-hmm. You visited the Havasupai Village at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. That must have been one heck of an experience.
It was incredible. It was an incredible experience. The tribe had 7 million acres was theirs, and they've been cut down to a few thousand acres. And even though that seems like a lot of land that they could still farm or have cattle, their water access was cut off when they first were cut down. And so, you know, during dry times, the crops would die and the cattle would die. So the circumstances are pretty dire. All their food, for the most part, has to be shipped in. And it's like government cheese, big blocks of cheese and white bread and Doritos. So there's not
very healthy stuff.
Yeah, and it was when I was there, it was almost 120 degrees. So it's not like you could ship in any greens or fruit and have it, you know, keep.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty desperate situation there. And
yeah, did it affect how you wrote the play? I mean,
it did.
Yeah?
It really
in what way?
Yeah, those specifics really changed. And I added a couple scenes for Arella after that. I felt like she needed as much weight in the play as Jillian does.
Hmm. Did you have your own moments of cultural miscommunication about what the tribe was really like, what life was like?
I did. And I've found myself stumbling along clumsily, just as my main character does in writing this play, making all sorts of assumptions and thinking I'm being culturally sensitive. But for one thing, in the New York Times, the article, there's a video showing the tribe collecting their blood. And in that video, they're singing a tribal song and going through some, you know, a ritual in collecting it. And I wanted to be very true to them and have that exact same song on stage. And I couldn't find it anywhere. And I asked a member of another tribe. I was very lucky to have members of the Seneca tribe helping me when I was getting the play first done in Rochester. And one of the members of the tribe said, "Oh, don't use that song. They would never want you to use the actual song on stage." And I said, "Well, what can I use?" And they said, "Well, make up a song, something, just make up words and make up a tune that's similar." And I thought, well, I'm Jewish. If I were going to use, you know, something that sounded sort of Yiddishy, I would be in big trouble. But that was making a big leap. I just made a lot of assumptions about what would be okay.
I think a little bit of the Yiddishy sneaked in there. It felt a little bit like I was listening to something like. So you're already working on another science play, I understand.
I am.
You're hooked. That's
good. I am definitely. Well, I just want to keep coming back to talk to you, Ira.
Well, it's our pleasure. What's this one going to be about?
It's about neurology. I'm interested in learning more about the brain. And so it's going to be, you know, we've known since Dostoevsky and before that a part of the brain that's affected by epilepsy or a tumor, and people have ecstatic religious experiences. And so I'm gonna have that happen to my main character in my new play.
I understand it's a comedy?
Yes.
A comedy about a brain tumor.
Yes, I'm dying for a comedy. We'll see how it goes. You'll tell me.
I want to know who's going to play the lead in. We'll have you back.
Good.
Thanks, Deborah. It's a wonderful play. It's Informed Consent. It's playing at the Duke Theater here in Manhattan through September 13th. Who knows? Maybe it'll get extended. It's going to go around the country?
Well, there's already people asking to do it.
Oh, that's terrific. Deborah, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Taking time to be with us today. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. And this week, a plant known as the corpse flower stunk up the Denver Botanic Garden with a rotten stench. You can guess what it smells like from the name, but the flower itself is a compelling sight to behold. And it's our picture of the week. And you can see it at sciencefriday.com. Corpse flower. It's a very unusual and unique sight and smell. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.